Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 321. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about national parks and saints and agriturismos as we go to Umbria in Italy. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. You know you're having a bad day flying when you're Clayton Osborne, who was charged with interfering with a flight crew, according to federal prosecutors in Texas. He started ranting about a bomb and terrifying passengers, and the odd thing about that is he was the pilot. Is it time to rethink giving the pilots guns and locking them in a cockpit? And then if you want to optimize your flight experience, one, get a captain who isn't crazy, and two, you might check out a new site called My Seat Finder. My Seat Finder, if you sign up and you give it your travel information as well as your frequent flyer numbers and passwords, then it can automatically upgrade you to a better seat if one becomes available. If you want a seat in something that goes fast but does not leave the ground, you might go to Exotics Racing in Las Vegas Motor Speedway, where you can get behind the wheel of a Lamborghini or a Ferrari. That might be my only opportunity. For links to all three of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome to the show Rebecca, who's coming to us from Umbria on the blog. And Rebecca is come to talk to us about the region of Italy known as Umbria.
Hello there.
Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And I say Umbria because that's how I say it, but I'm told that I'm saying it wrong here.
Well, the Italians say Umbria. Italian is luckily a phonetic language, so it's kind of an easy language to work yourself through because you pretty much pronounce every letter as it's written. And so the U is always an U in Italian, and so it's Umbria. But we accept Umbria as well.
When I was studying Italian, one of the things I liked about it is I can spell better in Italian than I can in English because
absolutely,
it's a little more consistent.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm not sure that everyone knows. Everyone's probably heard about Under the Tuscan Sun, but
yes,
this other neighboring region here, I'm not ever sure that everyone can find it on a map. So why don't we start by putting it on a map?
Absolutely. Well, unfortunately, Umbria lives eternally in the shadow of her neighbor to the north. Umbria borders on Tuscany to the south, and Umbria is right smack dab in the middle of the Italian peninsula. The, I guess, slogan or nickname that Umbria uses is Italy's green heart, and that is because it's right there in the middle, so it's sort of where the heart would be. And it is also kind of a heart shape, not really the Valentine's Day heart, more of an organic heart. So it's kind of heart-shaped. And it also is very green. We get a lot of precipitation here in the wintertime mostly. And so it's very verdant here. It's very green. And that's why it has this slogan.
Okay. So we're north of Rome and south of Florence.
Exactly.
And why should someone go to Umbria?
Well, Umbria is just far enough under the radar to give you some indie travel street cred, but it's not so far under the radar that traveling through the region is a logistical nightmare. Mm-hmm. As I said before, it kind of lives eternally in the shadow of its neighbor to the north in Tuscany, which is a shame because Umbria easily rivals Tuscany in things like art and architecture and archaeology, food and wine, all these things that people generally come to more of the rural parts of Italy for, the landscapes also. But in Umbria, there are dramatically less tourists than there are in Tuscany, though Umbria is slowly being discovered. So there's still vast areas in Umbria where you really don't hear a lot of English spoken. You won't run into a lot of tourists or travelers, you feel like you're having a much more authentic experience than in a lot of parts of Tuscany, where sometimes you feel like there are more English speakers than there are Italian speakers. That said, Umbria is not so far off the map that it's difficult to travel around. I mean, Umbria is the home of two very famous destinations. One is Assisi, which is the home of St. Francis. It's one of the most visited cities in Italy. And the other is Perugia, which is also our provincial capital. And it's the home of a very famous and historic university for foreigners. So there are a lot of foreigners who do come to Umbria. And this means that you're able to get around if you can't spit out a word of Italian, because there are a lot of Umbrians who have a working knowledge of English, and they do work with travelers and with tourists. There's a pretty good infrastructure to get around. There are lots of options for accommodation. There's a lot of helpful information for travelers, both online before someone departs and also at the tourist information offices once you're in the region. Umbria also has a bit of a cult following. So if you're kind of that type A trip planner who likes to get a lot of tips and info under your belt before you leave for a trip, a quick look through the travel forums, most notably the Slow Travel Forum, will give you lots of pointers on sites and restaurants and that kind of thing. So that's why you would consider coming to Umbria if you do want to sort of have that experience of not the big three. What we talk about, the big three when we talk about Italy, is of course Rome, Florence, and Venice. So you'd like to kind of get off that beaten track, but not so far off the beaten track that you feel uncomfortable. You feel like it would just be logistically more of a problem to organize your trip.
I think you actually just described my first trip to Italy, except for a day in Milan. So,
yeah, I think that for a first trip in Italy, that's actually a very good itinerary. When I have a lot of people who will contact me and ask me for suggestions about a first itinerary, and certainly a first itinerary, if you're going to be here longer than a week or two, I think that to try to do the big three in 1 week is probably stretching a little bit. But if you're going to be in Italy for at least 2 weeks, you should definitely go to those three cities. Those are on everybody's bucket list. However, you should also take some time to get away from those cities, because just like to get a real taste of what it's like to live in the U.S., you wouldn't only go to Manhattan, because not everyone lives in a place like Manhattan. To get a real taste of what it's like in Italy, you won't only go to Rome, because, of course, not everyone lives in a major metropolitan area like Rome. In fact, most Italians live in sort of the smaller towns in the rural countryside.
And if we're going to go to Umbria, what kind of itinerary would you recommend? Where would you start? Where would you go?
Well, Umbria is a region that kind of does offer a little bit of something for everyone. So I guess that would depend about what your interests are. For example, two things that I look for when I travel are food. I love to eat. And the other thing that I love to do when I travel is try to find kind of local handicrafts. And those are kind of two highlights that you would find in Umbria. If I were to structure an itinerary in Umbria, me personally, that's the kind of thing that I would structure it around. That said, Umbria is also a great place to come if you like to hike or bike. It's a place that has a lot of regional and national parks. It's a great place to come if you're very interested in art and architecture. It's a great place to come if you are very interested in archaeology.
Okay. And I'm going to get you a little more specific. And if we're just talking about someone like you, if you had a friend to come to visit, where would you take them? Where would you start?
Well, if it were a friend like me, it would definitely be someone who likes to eat and drink.
Works for me. If you don't like to eat and drink, you shouldn't go to Italy anyway.
Exactly. So, I mean, one of the highlights of a trip to Umbria should be the food. Umbria, like all of Italy, has a very strong and proud culinary tradition. And you have to remember that this region was very poor. It still is very rural, but it was very poor and rural until about the 1970s. And the cuisine still very much reflects that. This is the region of hunters and foragers. So on the menus, you'll find a lot of game, a lot of wild mushrooms and truffles, wild asparagus and field greens, that kind of thing. There are a lot of legumes on the menu. This is a region that didn't eat meat unless it was sort of once a week, or in the poor families, even only for holidays until just recently. So there are a lot of legumes still on the Umbrian menu, and a lot of heirloom legumes. Like there are lentils from a tiny little town called Castelluccio, which are actually protected. And there's a type of black-eyed pea from the area around Lake Trasimeno. Umbria has a very beautiful lake called Lake Trasimeno, and there's an heirloom lagoon from around here. This is also a region of pork eaters. I often say that Umbria is the Iowa of Italy, so there's a lot of charcuterie or cured meats in the form of salami and prosciutto and dried sausage that comes from both domesticated pork and wild boar. there's a great street food, which is called porchetta. It's also very kind of picturesque if you like to take these kind of photos. It's a whole pig that has been seasoned with garlic and wild fennel and deboned and all that kind of thing. And it's roasted whole, so it still has its head on and whatnot. And it gets sliced and it's served in these towering sandwiches from trucks in the main piazzas. So definitely one of the things that I would structure my trip around would be to do a little bit of homework even before I come, because Umbria, like all of Italy, eats very seasonally. So you sort of have to know what you're going to be looking for at the time that you're going to be here. So that would be one thing that I would do. I would also look into visiting the wineries. Wine tourism has had a huge boom recently in Umbria. I've been living here since 1993. And up until just a few years ago, when you would go to visit a winery, they would be kind of perplexed by that. They weren't really set up to do tastings at the winery. You'd sort of drive up and you'd have to kick chickens out of your way as you got out of the car. And the grandmother would kind of come out and pour you a glass of wine and look at you sort of perplexedly as to why you would want to come see the wine. And now, I mean, especially a couple of the bigger cantinas, the more international cantinas that do a lot of exporting, they really do look sort of like what we imagine a Napa Valley cantina. They're very sort of sharp and they're very architecturally modern and they're very well set up to serve people, even passersby. So I would definitely try to visit a winery or two while you're in Umbria. That would be one thing that I would structure my trip around.
And since you'd like to recommend us visiting a winery or two, do you have two that you would recommend to us?
Or three or four.
I will keep getting two. Can I get you to be specific?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are a plethora of wineries in Umbria that are historic wineries. One of my favorite wineries right now, however, is a snot-nosed upstart winery called Terre Margheritelle.
Which is not Italian for snot-nosed upstart. So.
No, it is not Italian for snot-nosed upstart. It's a new winery. They just opened about 6 years ago. It's in an area around a town called Torgiano. And they are making great wines. In a very short period of time, they've started making some amazing award-winning wines, especially Rosso di Torgiano, which is a DOC wine, a DOC wine. And I love visiting Terre Margheritelle because it's run by a couple called Federico and his American wife, Jennifer. Actually, Jennifer is a chef from Seattle. And so when you go to visit their winery, they're very welcoming. Their wine is fabulous. And they can set up also, alongside a visit to the winery and a tasting, also cooking classes. And they can also set up a winery tour on horseback because they're out in the countryside and right next door there's a horse paddock. Oh. It's fun because, of course, a lot of times when you're traveling, especially if you're traveling with a family or with other friends, there are people who don't drink. I know, it's strange, but there are people who don't drink.
I've heard that.
So one of the things that I like about Terre Margheritelle, there's kind of a little bit for everyone. Even if you're traveling with kids or if you're traveling with a mixed group and some people aren't really that interested to the wine side of it, they can kind of bide away their time on horseback or with a cooking class. When you come to Umbria, you absolutely have to try Sagrantino. Sagrantino is our flagship wine. It's not an easy wine. It's a tough wine. It's a very tannic wine. As I said, they use a lot of game here and a lot of pork. And so it's a wine that has to be paired with very pungent dishes. It's a hard wine actually for me to drink because I'm vegetarian, so it's hard for me. I have to have sort of a nice big plate of bean soup with a lot of peppery olive oil on it to cut through those tannins. But you definitely need to try Sagrantino while you're here. Sagrantino is in an area around Montefalco, which is actually one of my favorite towns here in Umbria. It's a beautiful hilltop town. And if you're going to try Sagrantino di Montefalco, you should probably head to Caprai. Caprai is a family that took Sagrantino from a small sort of basement. Every family made their own Sagrantino for their own use and put it into commercial production. And they have an absolutely gorgeous winery, very much sort of the Napa Valley winery on steroids. And it's all very modern and very sleek. But very often you'll actually run into Marco Caprai there and he will personally take you around the winery. And he's a very affable, very nice man.
Excellent. So now we're well-fed and just a little liquored up there.
Which means that it's time to spend money, right? Now you want to know about what's the other highlight, which is shopping.
And you mentioned crafts were something that
Not so much shopping, exactly. Okay. Exactly. I'm not a big shopper myself, but when I do spend money, I feel very strongly about spending money right when you travel. And one of the things that I like to do is try to support local artisans. And Umbria continues to have a really strong tradition of small artisan workshops. Italy in general is a country that the backbone of the Italian economy is the family business, and that continues to be true in Umbria in particular. Some products from Umbria are famous worldwide. Ceramics, Maiolica ceramics from Deruta and from Gubbio, you'll find all over the world, really. They're exported. Linens from Montefalco in Perugia are beautiful. There's a very traditional type of jacquard linen, which is absolutely gorgeous. Lace from Lake Trasimeno is very beautiful. There's an embroidery from Assisi called Punto Assisano, which is sort of, it looks like a medieval version of cross stitch. In Bivagno, which is another one of my favorite towns in Umbria, which is actually quite near my favorite town in Umbria, which is Montefalco, which is where they produce my favorite wine in Umbria, which is Sagrantino, to rewind the tape for a second. Umbria is actually a very tiny region, so all the towns are not more than maybe 45 minutes away from each other from end to end. In Bivagno, they've reproduced medieval workshops, and so you can, it's very fun. You can go and you can see how they would produce things like paper and silk and candles using the technology and the techniques from the 1400s. I know what just flashed through your mind. What just flashed through your mind was what was that King Richard's Fair? Remember those very sort of kitschy fairs from the 1980s?
Oh, the Renaissance Fair. Okay.
Exactly, the Renaissance Fair. No. They do not do Renaissance Fairs in Europe because in Europe, there actually was the Renaissance. So if you tried to do that, like wandering around and eating turkey legs, you would be laughed, right? I mean, here, when they say that they're building something using medieval technology, they're using really medieval technology. So it's fascinating. It's definitely something that's fun to visit as an adult, and it's also something fun to visit if you've got kids, because they've rebuilt these sort of medieval workshops, and it's really interesting to visit. And some of them are, you can actually buy the paper, for example, that they make, which is fun. That's all the history. Umbria also has kind of a hip side, and with a lot of young contemporary designers that are turning out a lot of high-end fashion and accessories. There's an eyeglass maker in Perugia called Ozzona who makes bespoke eyeglasses, which are very fun and very hip. There are a lot of jewelry designers in Umbria. Umbria has a very strong tradition of goldsmithing. Is that how we call it in English? Goldsmithing?
Sure.
My favorite is called Origami in Orvieto. It's an absolutely lovely store. There's a woman now making handmade leather bags called Giovanna Giuliani, and she's been in the press quite a bit lately. She makes some great stuff. So even if you're not really into the traditional kind of linen, maiolica, ceramic thing, you can also get some very hip, very contemporary things from young designers in Umbria.
You mentioned your favorite town.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think are maybe the two or three prettiest places in Umbria?
Two or three of the prettiest places. Well, you know, pretty is such a precious word. There are pretty places in Umbria. There are also breathtaking places in Umbria.
Okay.
So Montefalco is pretty. It's a pretty hilltop town. If I were to make a film about a small town in Italy with the perfect little piazza and the bell tower and the tables and the kids playing soccer, I would film it in Montefalco. It's pretty. One of my favorite places in Umbria is breathtaking, and that is the Piano Grande. The Piano Grande is a plateau, which is up in the Sibylline Mountains. There's a national park which straddles the border between Umbria and Le Marche, which is a bordering region. And it's breathtaking. It's one of those moments, like when you see the Grand Canyon for the first time, that it literally takes your breath away. Mm-hmm. And I always try to encourage people to go up there, which segues into something that I wanted to bring up while we chit-chatted about Umbria, which is I'm a huge proponent of renting a car when you visit Umbria. And I know that might seem counterintuitive for someone like me who is very much into sort of indie travel and responsible travel. But Umbria, in many ways, you can visit Umbria using public transportation. It is doable. That said, you end up missing a lot of Umbria because it's just Umbria is not logistically set up to connect the little hill towns to each other. It's set up like a hub. So you need to sort of stay in the provincial capital, which is Perugia, and move out from there, which means that you waste a lot of time going back and forth to the main train station. A lot of the hill towns, all of the hill towns that have train stations, the train station is actually in the valley beneath this historic center. So once you actually get there with the train, then you've got to take a city bus. And a lot of the most beautiful things in Umbria are the parks and the kind of natural areas that they're just inaccessible if you don't have your own transportation. One of these, for example, is the Piano Grande. Another breathtaking area of Umbria that I try to encourage people to visit is the Val Nerina, which is the Nera River Valley. The Nera River Valley has both the bad luck, the misfortune and the luck to be very inaccessible until about 20 years ago. Then they built a tunnel behind Spoleto, and now you can get to the Nera River Valley in about 5 minutes. It's either a 4-kilometer-long tunnel or a 7-kilometer-long tunnel. It's too long for my kids to hold their breath under as we drive under the tunnel.
Okay.
It's a very long tunnel. So what used to take 45 minutes to an hour of kind of mountainous roads going over the tops of these mountains, now you sort of drive through this tunnel and you're there, which is great for us now to visit because it is accessible, yet it hasn't really been ruined by a lot of modernization. So you go through this tunnel and you come out on the other side and you find yourself in a very dramatic sort of winding road that skirts the Nera River. On either side, you have these towering pinnacle mountains with these tiny creche-like villages perched on the sides of them. It's really dramatic. It's breathtaking. It's one of the most beautiful parts of Umbria. It's virtually unknown and it's completely inaccessible if you don't have your own transportation.
So it sounded like if we use public transportation, you'd say our option really would be to home base in the capital. But if we have the flexibility of the car, where would you put us for a home base?
Yes. As I said, if you don't have a car, your best bet is to stay in Perugia, which is the major rail hub. Mm-hmm. If you do have a car, your options open up enormously. I always suggest staying in one of the towns near the Valle Umbra. The Valle Umbra is the valley that runs down the center of the region.
Okay.
And that's also where, of course, the main highway and the main railway runs. So that way, in maximum 10 minutes, you're going to be with your car either on a major artery, or if you do decide to drop off your car for the day and you do want to take the train, you're going to be at one of the main train stations so that you can day trip to the towns, either to the north or south of where you're staying. So what are the main towns along the Valle Umbra? Assisi, Spello, Spoleto, Trevi, all of these are very pretty hill towns. So in the evening, you can either enjoy that kind of unique atmosphere of staying in one of these historic town centers, or you can find an accommodation out in the country. It's chock full of farm holidays, which are called in Italian agriturismi. Mm-hmm. Exactly. For listeners who don't know what that is, an agriturismo is a farm that offers either or accommodations or a restaurant service. Most of them offer both. And they can go from simple farmhouses with a bed and breakfast type of setup to farmhouses that have been divided into independent self-catering apartments. In fact, I own a farmhouse like that that's called Brigolante. And some of them are luxury villas with spas. I mean, they really run the gamut. But they have to have legally a working farm, basically. And this is a great way to experience Umbria, a great way to really experience its rural roots, and also a great way to feel like you are contributing to maintaining a lifestyle that is disappearing little by little. Because, of course, in Umbria, as in all over the world, all over the developed world, I should say, these rural roots are getting lost. So most of these farms only still exist because of the money they're bringing in by offering accommodations to travelers.
Excellent. If I asked your kids what their favorite part of Umbria was, what would they tell me?
Well, you would ask them at the perfect time because just 2 days ago, we went to the Scuola del Cioccolato, which is the chocolate school. In Perugia, there is a historic chocolate factory called Perugina, and many people may know of it because of their most famous chocolate, which is the bacio. The bacio are those small foil-wrapped chocolates that have a hazelnut in them. When you open them up, they have a little love message on the inside. Perugina is one of Umbria's biggest industries. It exports their chocolates to, I think, something like 60 countries. Mm. You can visit the museum. You can visit the chocolate factory, which is, of course, fabulous. Anyone who has either seen Lucille Ball or read the Curious George book harbors a wish to see a real working chocolate factory. You can do both of those things. And they also have a chocolate school. And I took my sons there just last Friday, I guess. I was a little bit trepidatious because I wasn't exactly sure if they were set up to deal with kids. My kids are 7 and 10, so they're not toddlers, but they're also not completely independent. And it was great. It was a great afternoon. They were very welcoming. They were obviously thrilled to have a couple of kids there. They give you a project to do, so we made chocolate Easter eggs. It was a great time. It really was a great time. So if you are traveling to Umbria with kids, that's definitely something that I would suggest doing. Umbria is kid-friendly in a lot of ways. Italy in general is kid-friendly because Italians genuinely love kids. Umbria is also kid-friendly because a lot of the things that there are to do and see in Umbria involve being outside. Even the medieval towns themselves, a lot of the charm of the medieval hilltop towns is just simply wandering through the streets, buying yourself a gelato, sitting out in the main piazza soaking up the sun. Umbria, for such a small region, is full of regional and national parks. I think there are 8 or 9 regional and national parks in Umbria. Umbria, which is a crazy number given the size of Umbria. So you can always take your kids just to some sort of mountainous plain and let them run around and kick a soccer ball around or do what they want to do there. One of the things that my children love to do, a lot of these hilltop towns, of course, have a fortress, and a lot of these fortresses are open to the public. One of the best ones to visit is here in my hometown of Assisi. It's called the Rocca Maggiore. It's a big stone fortress that's set on top of the mountain, so kind of on top of the town of Assisi itself. Mm-hmm. And it's fabulous fun for kids because it's just restored enough that you're not worried about them breaking a leg, but it's just not restored enough that they feel like they're being adventuresome. Mm-hmm. So there are turrets to climb and there are tunnels to go through and there are courtyards to run around. It's great fun. People who live in Assisi can go in for free. I can't remember. I think it's about €5 to get in for a ticket, but residents can get in for free and it's the de facto playground. So in the summertime, kids are just running wild over because all the parents bring their kids there and we sit in the courtyard and read a book and our kids all climb to that top of the tallest tower and look with a conqueror's eye over the Umbrian plain.
That sounds terrific for me. And I, you know, just, I'm not a kid, but.
No, it is. It's terrific fun for adults as well. Actually, it is.
No, I have been to Italy. I was going to say I haven't been through Umbria. I'm probably driven through Umbria, but I haven't really stopped in Umbria.
Well, my friend, it's time you come.
It is indeed. So I think I know Italy. What's going to mm-hmm. surprise me about Umbria?
A good surprise or a bad surprise?
Either one or both.
Okay, so the unpleasant surprise, the bread sucks. The bread sucks in Umbria. I mean, I'm sorry if you're going to have to edit out the word sucks, but let's just say it. The bread sucks in Umbria. I guess to be more diplomatic, the bread in Umbria is an acquired taste. The thing is, we think of Italian bread as a homogenous food item. Mm-hmm. But bread, like everything else that Italians eat, varies wildly from region to region. Right. So even within the same region, what southern Italians eat and what northern Italians eat are dramatically different. So there is no Italian bread. There are dozens of different types of bread that are eaten in Italy, depending upon where you are. So when I got here, I expected to eat what we consider in the U.S. Italian bread, quote unquote, which is that kind of flaky, crusted, chewy crumb bread that you mm-hmm. get in a basket when you go to the Italian restaurant. Only to find that in Umbria, they eat what they call pane comune, which is common bread, which is kind of a dry crumb, saltless, very flat tasting bread that's found here in Umbria. It's found in a lot of parts of central Italy. It's found in a lot of parts of Tuscany as well. Can you acquire the taste for pane comune? Yes, but you need to eat it as it's meant to be eaten. We tend to eat bread in the U.S., in Northern Europe, Anglo-Saxons in general, tend to eat bread as a food item unto itself. Mm-hmm. Italians, especially Italians who are eating pane comune, don't eat bread as a food. They consider it a means of transport. Okay. So what you use it for is to either get those last drops of that pungent pasta sauce, which is going to be made in Umbria either with truffles or with wild boar, with something very, very pungent. Hmm. So you either use it to clean those last drops of sauce off your plate, or you use it with that very salty cured pork that they eat a lot here. So with the salami, with the prosciutto, whatnot. So if you eat it like that, it's perfect because, of course, it has no flavor itself. It's just a means of transport. A little side note about the cleaning the pasta sauce off your plate. That's kind of not something you're supposed to do in restaurants. I do it all the time, but just look sheepish. Because that way you're communicating to the people around you that you know you're kind of not supposed to do that, but it's too strong of a desire. You can't stop yourself. So if you have to do that in a restaurant, which I do all the time, I just kind of look sheepish while I do it.
And how about a pleasant surprise?
A pleasant surprise, again, to beat a dead horse, all the parks that are here in Umbria. Umbria mm-hmm. really is the green heart of Italy. You don't realize until you get here how green it really is. This tiny, tiny region with all of these parks. So a visit to Umbria without at least one visit, a leisurely drive through at least one of the parks, it really would be remiss to miss them. It's hard to visit Umbria without at least inadvertently setting foot into Assisi. The town of Assisi, for example, is inside a regional park, as is Gubbio, as is a number of towns that any visitor would have on their short list. But most of the parks center around a mountain peak, actually. So what you want to do is head to the top of whatever that mountain peak is going to be, either driving or hiking, because a lookout over the surrounding countryside from that vantage point is just going to be unforgettable.
And your favorite park?
oh, hands down, the Mount Sibylline National Park. But I feel like I'm being unfair because it's sort of like saying, what's your favorite car? And you pull a 1964 Ford Mustang out of the hat. I mean, you can't be comparing that to other cars. So definitely the Mount Sibylline National Park, that's the park that I mentioned before that has the Piano Grande, which mm-hmm. is the plateau. Also, the Nera River Valley, the Val Nerina that I discussed before, is a park as well. That's probably my favorite park just because there are so many interesting things you can do there. As I said, it's beautiful just to drive along the river and you've got these craggy mountain peaks on both sides. There are a dozen little villages that you can visit, which is fun. There are two abbeys that you can visit. They're just beautiful. They're so peaceful. The biggest waterfall in Europe is actually a waterfall called the Marmore Waterfall, which is on the Nera River. So it's there in that park, and that's a lot of fun to do. And also, I'm a collector of quirky museums, and there is a very quirky museum in the Nera River Valley, which is a mummy museum. And there's an interesting story about this. It was one of those strange things that there was a law under Napoleon. So Napoleon, he put a moratorium on burials under churches. And so the towns needed to start burying their dead in cemeteries, and they needed to empty out their crypts. And so when this tiny town called Ferentillo on the Nera River did that, they went down into their crypt to empty out the dead. They found that their dead had all mummified. There's a microclimate underneath that particular church that mummifies the dead. And so they have now, there's maybe about 20 mummies on display. They're in glass cases. And it's quirky, and it's also a little bit, it's strange. It could be macabre, but there's just something about going to this tiny, and you have this chirpy village woman who's taking you around and saying, oh, and look, you can still see the lesions from leprosy on this mummy. Just the whole thing is just one of those quirky travel moments that you think to yourself, only here in Ferentillo would I be looking at mummies under this tiny medieval church. It's just fun.
So you've been writing about Umbria now. Blogging about it.
I have. I've been writing and blogging about Umbria for about 10 years.
As people start to discover Umbria, or rediscover it probably more accurately, and what do you wish they would stop writing about this and start writing about this instead?
One of my pet peeves is when I see people write or give the advice, the tip, to skip Assisi because it's too crowded, which I think is just ridiculous. It's like saying go to France but skip Paris because it's too crowded. Obviously, the reason that Assisi is crowded is that it's unskippable. You absolutely must see Assisi. Is it full of tourists? Absolutely. But there's a reason for that. It's simply the loveliest town in the region. It's one of the loveliest towns in all of Italy. So what you need to do is you need to organize yourself to visit Assisi, right, in the sense of you need to time it so that you either get there early in the morning or extend your visit late into the evening. A lot of the crowds in Assisi are the day trippers. There's a lot of religious pilgrimage that happens. The Basilica of St. Francis is in Assisi. Assisi is St. Francis's hometown.
So about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, everybody gets on a tour bus and leaves town.
Exactly. So you either need to get there when the church opens in the morning. There have been times that I've been there in the morning that I've been the only person in the Basilica of St. Francis, which is a very special experience, even if you're not Catholic. It's a wondrous church, and it's so special to be there and enjoy it in silence. Or you need to stay until sunset when they close down the church again, and you can enjoy it in silence again. And the thing about Assisi is it seems like it's very crowded because, of course, everyone goes to the Basilica and to the main piazza. But I'm always amazed when I walk through the back streets of town. There's absolutely no one in the little lanes. You're 50 meters away from the main piazza, which is teeming with people. So all you need to do is time your visit. I suggest actually that people stay overnight in Assisi because it just makes it easier to kind of avoid that. And also if you can be in Assisi at night when the city is lit with the street lamps, it's beautiful. So that's one of my pet peeves. I've been seeing that more and more kind of on the travel forums and in articles about people saying, come to Umbria, but skip Assisi because it's too crowded. And I just think that's the most inane piece of advice that I've ever read.
Okay. And people don't write about what? That they really should. The most undiscovered or least appreciated part of Umbria.
I think one of the things that I find so special about Umbria are all the festivals that they have here.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason that they were not written about until just recently, and I'm seeing them starting to be discovered now, and I hope that they're discovered more. We have this idea of Italians being sort of accordion playing, laughing, singing, hugging, very much the Disney-esque parody of the Italian. Some Italians are like that. Those are Southern Italians.
I was going to say,
from
yeah.
Rome northward, and Northern Italians are very staid. They're very reserved.
Northern Italians are Germans.
Exactly, exactly.
I mean, both that they're from Lombard and things like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Culturally. And so if you come to Umbria and you expect yourself to get bear hugged and danced around the piazza, that's not going to happen. It will happen, however, 1 week out of every year in every town, a different week. And that is the week that they're having whatever their festival is.
Oh,
that really is the week during the year that that town will let their hair down. The town gets decked out and their banners and flags, the taverns kind of sprout up overnight like mushrooms. Taverns are these outdoor kind of eating places. Mm-hmm. The music goes on all night. Every town has a different festival. Some of them are based on their patron saint. Some of them are medieval festivals. And that's a great time to visit these towns. It's a great time to visit Umbria in general. And they weren't talked about until very recently because
all the information was in Italian.
All the information was in Italian, mm-hmm. mostly because these festivals were not for tourists. Mm-hmm. They were for the town themselves.
Right.
Assisi has a huge festival called Calendimaggio, and the Assisians call it their birthday party. It's their party. The mm-hmm. Assisians put it on for their own enjoyment. They're starting to discover now that they can fund their own festival by actually making it accessible. Not accessible in the sense of it was closed off physically. There just wasn't information out there, either
right.
in Italian or in any other language. It was very hard to get information about where to go, what times, what to see. They're starting to open up these festivals a little bit more because they're realizing that there really is a tourist attraction there. Of course, it's a delicate balance of not ruining the feel of the festival by opening it up. But I would be very happy to see these festivals become more popular, become more accessible, become more enjoyed, because it really is, I think, a way that you can experience Umbria in a way that's completely different than just sort of walking through the quiet streets, because Umbria does have a very joyous, very lighthearted side that it's hard when you're walking through these very staid, somber, medieval stone towns. You don't really get that. When you're there during their festival, as I said, when the drummers are out and everyone's in medieval costume, and to be quite frank, everyone is just a little bit tipsy,
yeah.
It gives you a completely different side of Umbria. It's great fun, and it's a great way also to, again, to feel like you are, when you travel, participating in keeping a tradition alive. You're adding something rather than taking it away.
So we're going to check a calendar. We're going to check where we want to go and what their feast days are.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, what season is probably the best at seeing in Umbria?
My favorite times to come to Umbria are May and September.
Shoulder season, okay.
Yeah, halfway through September. The thing about coming to Umbria in wintertime, as I said, Umbria is Italy's green heart. Why is it so green? We get a lot of precipitation.
Rain, yeah.
So if you're coming from Seattle, you're going to think the weather's great here in January. If you're coming from anywhere else, you're going to be sitting around. You know, these very charming piazzas lose a lot of their charm under a cold, icy, driving rain. And we get a lot of that in the wintertime, and thank mm-hmm. goodness that we do. This winter, for example, we got hardly any rain at all, and we're very, very worried about what is going to be happening mm-hmm. this summer, rain-wise. If you are here in the summertime, it does get hot. I mean, Umbria is a region where there are four seasons, so it gets very cold and rainy in the winter. It gets hot in the summertime. Is it a heat that is unbearable? No, it's not Rome here. You can head to the tops of the hills, and the heat is bearable. That said, it is very hot. This is not a country where there's a lot of air conditioning. If you come in those shoulder seasons, first of all, that's when most of the festivals are going on in the shoulder season.
Okay.
So kind of the spring and the fall are when most of the festivals are going on. Umbria also has some great music festivals, and those generally happen in the spring and the fall.
Classic or modern music festivals?
Both.
Or both?
Okay. Both. Right. Circling back to foodstuffs, some of my favorite foodstuffs are connected with the spring and the fall. Fall is, of course, olive oil and wine, and spring is mm-hmm. a lot of the great seasonal fruit and vegetables are coming out in the spring. So weather-wise and also crowd-wise, because
sure.
school is still in. School is not out yet, so there's not a lot of families traveling yet because school is in. but it's not summertime, so families aren't traveling. It's a good time that there's just enough crowd around to feel like you're not wandering through completely deserted streets, but not too much that it takes away the enjoyment of visiting Umbria.
Okay. We're going to start to wind this down. Mm-hmm. Before I get to my final two questions, which everyone who's listened regularly knows what those are.
You have just struck fear into my heart. I knew I should have researched. Oh.
You live in Umbria.
Yes, I do.
Who was the first Umbrian you really got to know, who really made an impression on you that this is someplace that you could live?
I came to Umbria as an exchange student in high school. Mm-hmm. In a year that I will not reveal to you, but let us just say that it was the Paleolithic age when we would actually send letters overseas. Not only letters, but they would be the letters on that onion skin airmail mm-hmm, paper. Mm-hmm. You remember that?
I do remember that.
And I stayed with a family. The family's daughter stayed with my family in Chicago for 2 months, and I stayed with the family here in Assisi, actually.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I'm still in contact with them. The daughter of that family is married with children, and her children go to school with my kids at a small town. And the first person who made an impression on me when I came was her mother. I'll probably get a little bit worked up because she actually just passed away last year. And she was so kind to me when I came. I'm sorry, do you always have guests who start crying when you ask this question? No. But it was the first time. I was very young. I was 15. It mm-hmm. was the first time I'd ever left my home. As I said, it wasn't a time that you were Skyping with your family. There was no Facebook. It was very isolating. Traveling in the generation before this generation was traveling. When you left, you left. That was it. And you would get a letter maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks. You wouldn't call overseas. It was too expensive. It was very much more a feeling of distance than there is now. Mm-hmm. So to come to this family, to be so welcomed, and to have this woman that I had only met 10 minutes earlier say, "Please call me Mom," was very, very important and very touching to me. I miss her very much.
The last two questions are going to be much easier compared to that.
No, we're editing that part out. This is what you get when you call people at midnight.
That's right. Finish this sentence for me. You really know you're in Umbria when what?
I'm just laughing because there's so many expats who live in Italy, and we just laugh. There's so many quirks about Italian culture in general. Mm-hmm. So you really know you're in Umbria when you are ironing your pajamas. They iron everything in Italy. Everything. Underwear, socks, pajamas. And I'm laughing about this because my son just had his very first sleepover party a couple of weeks ago. And he comes to me and he said, "I need to pack my bag for the sleepover." And I said, "Okay, let me make sure that you have a pair of ironed pajamas." And I thought to myself, those are words that never came out of my mother's mouth. Anyone who's ever lived in Italy will laugh about that because they know that, man, do Italians iron.
That's funny. And if you had to summarize Umbria in 3 words, what 3 words would you use?
I would say quiet rolling hills.
Excellent.
That's what I'm looking at out my window right now.
Excellent. Rebecca, where can people read more about your love affair with Umbria?
Well, I write for 2 blogs. One is umbriaontheblog.com. The other is brigolante.com. You can also follow me on Facebook and Twitter. You just need to look up Brigolante. You'll find me there.
Excellent. And we'll put links to both those in the show notes.
Great.
Rebecca, thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing us with your love of Umbria.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
I want to thank everyone who sent best wishes with this change in jobs and the changes in the amateur traveler that may come as a result of that. I also heard this week from Lisa, who wrote, "I discovered the amateur traveler when I was preparing to take a 3.5 month leave from work to travel and teach raw food cuisine. I had great adventures through India, Thailand, Bali, Australia, New Zealand, and Hawaii, often with your familiar voice in my earbuds. Now, as soon as your theme song comes on, I smile and feel transported to those moments on buses, trains, and planes that I spent with you and your guests." Well, Lisa, the only regret I have is that I wasn't with you, especially in India, Thailand, and Bali.
Brad wrote with a critique about the show that we had lost the maps that we sometimes had in the iTunes enhanced version that showed you where we were talking about. You'll notice that in this episode, if you were watching, had a map of where Umbria is in Italy. We lost that when we switched from me doing the editing to Mike doing the editing, and I forgot to tell him that that would be a good idea. So my apologies and thanks to Brad for pointing that out. I heard from Jim, who commented on the episode on Lanai and said, I listened to this today while driving, can't use the iTunes enhanced then, and it brought back memories of the time my wife and I took a boat ride over there from Lahaina. This would have been in the mid-1980s. We spent part of the day on a van tour of Lanai, including the area with the Cook Island pines, which the locals tend to hate. Then we snorkeled from a nice empty beach where the waves were just a tiny bit too rough for good snorkeling. Afterwards, during our return voyage to Maui, we listened to the radio where the crew was being appraised of a tsunami warning. There had been an earthquake in Alaska and low-lying areas were being evacuated. We were staying at Kanapali, which is in a low-lying area, so when we got back to Lahaina, the bus dropped us off at Kanapali and we headed for the high ground in our sandy, salty bathing suits and hung out on the golf course on the top of the hill waiting for the all clear, which came a few hours later. We were staying in a condo and had an egg salad sandwiches for dinner, looking out from our lanai on all the people who were going hungry because the restaurants were all closed due to the emergency. Glad to hear your trip to Lanai was less eventful. Jim, I was glad as well. With that, we're going to wrap up this episode of The Amateur Traveler. If you have any comments, feel free to leave them on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. Drop me an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or do what Jim did, which is leave a comment on this thread in the Facebook community, facebook.com/amateurtraveler. You can also follow me on Twitter @Chris2X. And as always, thanks so much for listening.